KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levy, and I am an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for tuning in today. And today we're going to be talking with Dean John Garron of Hamline University's School of Law, who's authored a new book called Own It, The Law and Business Guide to Launching a New Business Through Innovation, Exclusivity, and Relevance. And this is a very interesting book and actually a little bit different focus than we've come to expect on Hearsay Culture. Dean Garron has written a book that is directed, and he'll explain in more detail, at people that are really trying to start businesses, and he describes in very good detail the nature of intellectual property law generally and the issues that you have to think about as you decide how to set up your business model and where you think you want to go with your business. And the cover of his book really lays through a variety of issues, from forming LLCs to capital to non-disclosure agreements, partnerships, etc. We're going to be focusing on the intellectual property aspects in particular and really kind of taking a look at it from the standpoint of some of the issues that Dean Garron raises, as well as the larger question of where we are with intellectual property law. I should also add, with respect to the book, that the book comes in two parts, and we're going to be focusing on the first part. The first part really lays out the substance of the book in terms of what issues Dean Garron identifies as the issues that a new business should focus on. But the second part of the book is also a very interesting and useful guide to intellectual property law. We're not going to focus on that part of the book other than to reference it, because really what I want to get into here is the idea of ownership and what Dean Garron is focusing on here. As listeners of Hearsay Culture would know, and certainly based upon my background with the Center for Internet and Society, I have a lot of concerns with respect to how far and where intellectual property law has gone with respect to ownership. The idea of whether we're focusing more on rewarding authorship and less focusing on the progress of science and useful arts aspect of intellectual property law. And I know Dean Garron may or may not agree with some or all of the statements I make. We're going to have some of those discussions and perhaps have a little bit of a debate, as it were, on some of the issues. But the larger issue of what Dean Garron is trying to achieve here, I think, is a laudable one, because intellectual property law remains a mystery. And again, for listeners Hearsay Culture, they know quite well that while I have very strong opinions, I do not attempt to make my show purely dogma for one side or the other, and to the extent that I can have on guests who may not agree with me 100%, the more the merrier, and indeed I think it makes for good radio. And also, more specifically, it focuses on what the primary objective of Hearsay Culture is, which is education. And so while some listeners may be frustrated when I have on guests with whom they do not agree, the larger goal here is really to try to get that educational element out there. And to that end, Dean Garron's book is focused functionally on helping businesses and less, I think, although we'll discuss this, on really making normative judgments about where the law should be. But nonetheless, given Dean Garron's extensive experience in intellectual property, we'll have that discussion. And to that end, a very brief introduction. Dean Garron brings 15 years of practicing and teaching law to Hamline University, where he's the dean. From 1988 to 89, he worked with Shane Gould, focusing in various forms of litigation. He also ran a solo practice. He worked for Hughes and Fisher in Newport Beach, California, facilitating growth of entertainment law, which is an area that he's been focusing in for quite a while. He started teaching in 1993 at Western State College of Law in Fullerton, California, teaching IP, entertainment, and business law. He worked in various capacities there. And then from 1999 to 2001, he was a member of the Entrepreneurial Law Center Advisory Board at the school. He joined Franklin Pierce in Concord, New Hampshire, where he taught IP, and then in 2000, and joined Hamline as a professor and dean of the School of Law on July 1st, 2003. So Dean Garron brings a wealth of experience here, and I'm really thrilled to have him on the show. So I think if I've done my job properly here at my home offices in Charlotte, North Carolina, on the other end of the phone is John. John, are you there?
I am here.
John, thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Let's start right out with kind of a standard initial question, which I've discussed your background a little bit, and perhaps you could expand on it with a focus on why you decided to write this book.
There are generalizable.
The focus here, in particular intellectual property, leads to an interesting question, which is, as you over the years as you've discussed intellectual property, and indeed as it's become a little bit more popular in terms of the general knowledge of people because of technology, what are you finding now is generally is the level of understanding that you think the average business person has in intellectual property, and then more specifically the entrepreneur to whom you focus this book?
There are a small number of entrepreneurs, the ones who get the most press, who come from a patent world where they are inventors with inventions, and that aspect of the population is very sophisticated. The vast majority of entrepreneurs have heard of those people, don't have any idea how that applies to what they're doing, and in fact, the general knowledge base for intellectual property, although people know it's out there, is actually very low. And so the reason for the second part of the book, the piece that you identified, is really to provide just a basic walkthrough so that people understand what it is that they need to build those building blocks to help them get the company off the ground.
The nature of the book, I think, is suggested right there in the title, which leaves very little ambiguity. But I do want to focus on it initially. What do you mean by own it?
Exactly what you said. I really mean that for a startup business to be successful, it has to be able to have exclusivity in its market niche. If it's going into a new business area, it has to have something that's not already being provided in the market, or it's going to fail to those who are already in the market. It has to own its space in the marketplace. By and large, the way it does that is through some aspect of intellectual property.
Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting dichotomy that I want to make sure I understand clearly. When you talk about ownership, you're talking about owning a market space, or are you talking about more than that, also owning the content that you intend to provide?
There is such a panoply of intellectual property tools that it's not necessarily a book that says you have to have a patent in order to be successful. Peter Drucker, 25 years ago, focused quite a bit on innovation as a strategy. And, of course, if you think of process innovation is really based on trade secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, businesses understand that if they have, you know, to quote the old saying, built a better mousetrap, they have an opportunity in the marketplace. But if you have built a better mousetrap and a major competitor can copy that mousetrap within a couple days, or today with the Internet within a couple hours, that's not going to create enough space for you to be in the marketplace. So you have to put in appropriate strategies to make sure whatever innovation you're adding gives you room to compete.
The two words that you mentioned one already that you focus on initially are exclusivity and relevance. And so I guess follow-up question is what you mean by those two words.
Well, the first we just talked about, exclusivity means there is something that is unique to the business, that it is the number one source for that thing, whatever it is. And exclusivity can come from very small slices of the pie. So, for example, copyright is the easiest place to gain exclusivity. If I write a novel or a play, it's mine. There are millions of competing novels or plays, but no one can reproduce the exact same one.
Mm-hmm.
Relevance is a slightly less legal concept, and it's much more a business concept. And relevance goes to the importance of the consumer. And there are two kinds of relevance that I identify in the book. One is objective relevance, something that the market actually needs, right? Food, shelter, water, clean air, things that objectively you need. And the more that something is objectively relevant, the more likely there is going to be a demand for it. If you have the exclusivity for that objectively relevant product, you're going to be successful. The most obvious example of that, of course, is pharmaceutical patents, where you have a life or death need for the drug, and you have an absolute exclusivity over the distribution of the drug. The second kind of relevance is subjective relevance. And subjective relevance is just as powerful a market force, although it's oftentimes not thought of by economists and by others. And that is, how hot is an item? How important is it to my audience? hot concert ticket, first in line to a film opening, the latest Barbie doll, whatever that subjective relevance is, also helps predict a market. The best market is one that has both objective and subjective relevance and a high degree of exclusivity. Those are the extremely successful companies, the companies that go from the garages to the Fortune 500. But understanding that dichotomy allows one to build one's business strategy over time.
It's a topic that I want to come back to, which is really kind of, and it touches on a topic that you discuss in a book, which is, you know, the long tail, which has been made, you know, well known now by Chris Anderson's book. And we'll come back to that because I want to first just kind of get a baseline on the book itself. And one interesting thing is, and just to flesh it out a little bit, as I mentioned in the introduction, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you're not making value judgments about the nature of intellectual property in this book, are you?
Generally not. There are some sidebars in the book, and I do identify a few things. As an academic, a few things slip into the book. So there are some abuses of the intellectual property regimen that I point out. There are some best practices of the intellectual property regimen that I try to point out. So, for example, I am very impressed by the Apple license agreement for the iPod and iPhone, in that they recognized how consumers behave in terms of downloads and have the right to make multiple copies in the license. By understanding that subjective relevance, to put it in the terms of the book, that was the decision that Apple made that made its download service much more successful than other technologically equivalent services.
And so just to follow up on that point, so are you focusing, and again, to get the breadth of the book, clearly when we talk about intellectual property, it's not divorced from contract law, it's not divorced from tort law. If we focus on trade secrecy, it's not divorced from unfair competition. How far are you going in this book? Because the cover of your book runs through a variety of issues. We're focusing on intellectual property, but is the idea of your book that intellectual property being an area, you know, in which you're an expert, is the underlying theory that a new entrepreneur needs to understand in order to apply the system that you recommend here?
It really is. The assumption that I'm making is that there are a number of strategies out there for the mechanics of starting a business, and this is not a how-to-start-a-business book. What this is saying is small businesses fail at an inordinate rate, and while financing is one of the key reasons for it, the lack of exclusivity, the relevance of your company, are probably the dominant reasons that small businesses fail, and you can't create separation from your business from other businesses without the exclusivity that intellectual property provides. It is the only mechanism for which a business can have separation, whether it's, you know, through employment agreements and publicity and non-disclosure agreements, or through much more concrete things such as patents and trademarks. Those are the only tools there. Without exclusivity, your business is guaranteed to fail. So it's a necessary but not sufficient piece of the startup mix.
Let's take a look here as we get into some of the substantive side of the book, and also what is admittedly both of interest, I think, to people focusing on intellectual property law generally in the growth of businesses, but also to the individual who may purchase your book that doesn't have the background and would want to read this book for that purpose. But one of the ideas, or one of the perhaps countervailing, I'm not sure, theories of business growth that came to mind as I was reading through your book is Henry Chesbrough's work and others in the world of open innovation. And Henry's been on the show a couple of times, in fact, so the listeners of Hearsay Culture are quite familiar, I think, with his theories. But what's your opinion generally in the of the idea of open innovation, the idea that one way to innovate in a business is, in fact, to share information as opposed to controlling it?
I think that makes a lot of sense, and for certain businesses or for certain components of a business, those are critical strategic decisions to make. One of the core questions that an entrepreneur or an established company has to identify is, what is it the product or service content is not what it sells. And that was the inspiration that has led MIT to open up most of its courses, virtually all of its courses, to the public, because there's no loss to the business if it gives away all of its course content, because the business needs and the market needs to have the licensure, to have gone through the courses to prove that one is eligible for the PhD or the law degree or the master's, whatever the program is. That creates the ability for businesses to say, these are the things we want to focus on owning. These are the things that are relevant to us. Everything else we can relax about and be much more collaborative, much more efficient, and by doing so be successful across the board.
Are the theories mutually exclusive as a general matter? In other words, do you think that there's a conflict at a fundamental level between the idea of ownership, as you describe in the book, and open innovation?
No, I think they are strategies on a continuum. For example, in open source software, I think open source provides both some great market innovation. It taps into the volunteer resource, whether it be of student programmers or a public community, and at the same time, the open source structure couldn't exist without copyright law, because otherwise people would use other strategies to cordon off and proprietize different aspects of the open source market. So you need to have a healthy intellectual property regime to allow the very kind of innovation that you want.
And I want to talk about where intellectual property law is generally in a few minutes, but to explore a little bit more the world of open innovation, the theory goes not only, as you know, to issues of what your market is, but also indeed how you develop the product that you have. And so not only is the theory suggesting that you share the content, but also that you share your research and development. I mean, the idea being, as you know, that before you even get to market, the kind of research that would normally be held very confidentially, clearly would be proprietary, would be protected certainly by trade secrecy, but also by contract law generally, should in fact be made public. And so we've seen that idea expressed in the sharing of patent applications. Indeed, you can make the argument that the Peer-to-Patent Project, which is getting off the ground over the last several months, is an idea, is a concept at least partially involved in open innovation. So I guess with respect to your theory of ownership and owning, is there a cutoff point where your hypothetical, or to use the hypothetical of the startup, the company with no assets in the market, could say that they could use both the ownership theory and open innovation at the same time? Or are there companies where, or entities where you think that open innovation ultimately is not a viable option?
Well, there's certainly a range of outcomes that can exist. The intellectual property regimes collectively are just a toolbox. So at one end, you have companies, Red Hat may be a good example. Basically, it is providing service on an open source Linux software platform that's available for many others. Its trademark has allowed it to be very aggressive in the service side of the business surrounding what is a free product. At the other end, I think you do have tremendous pressures in the pharmaceutical arena, where you have privacy of the individuals who are the subjects of the data collection. Have tremendous sunk costs in the development of new products, new materials, and so it's very difficult in that area, where, particularly when you're talking about human trial testing, to think of that in a very open way. But even having said that, we can certainly look at particular projects, whether it be AIDS medication or particular kinds of cancers, where we can look at a private-public partnership to say, for this particular agenda, we are using federal funds, and therefore, just like the WPA did with theater in the 30s, these dollars are for people who are going to disclose, within the academic community at least, 100% of the data and the research, because we're trying to speed up our success to market. Mm-hmm. All of the possibilities exist, and it really is on a case-by-case basis what's the best strategy.
Are you concerned at all that well, let me take a step back. You refer to open source as a dilemma, and of course I want to ask you what you mean by the word dilemma. But it does suggest, and clearly your title suggests, that, and at least, again, which is why I'm asking the questions, the knee-jerk reaction would be, well, open innovation sounds entirely opposite of what Dean Garen is suggesting in the book, and you do refer to open source as a dilemma, but what is, in fact, the nature of the dilemma that you describe here?
Well, the dilemma for open source is how best to balance it and utilize it. It creates some real opportunities for companies, particularly for non-software companies, of course, because it lowers the cost of doing business. But even for companies who are creating products, it creates a challenge because you're conceding to the market one of your exclusive tools. You're conceding the copyright in your product, but you're only conceding one of them. So it creates a strategy decision that if you are creating a highly subjectively relevant software game, for example, you're going to emphasize and embed your trademark interests so that your company remains the relevant company in the distribution of that product. Perhaps you're giving it away because you want to draw attention to other products that you provide. Perhaps you're giving it away for other different kinds of strategies. The fact that you're conceding the copyright doesn't mean that you're necessarily out of business, but you have to look at the other tools that you have to continue to have some exclusivity so that you're part of the marketplace.
The open source dilemma is one that I think really has obviously challenged the basic utilitarian theory of intellectual property law itself. And I guess I'll ask your opinion now, stepping away from the focus of the book, which is whether, in your view, the open source movement itself and its relative success calls into question that utilitarian theory.
I don't think it does at all. And again, my background coming from community theater, right, is a version of open source intellectual property or copyright development that has a century on its software equivalent. What it does is it creates a bed for innovation, for creativity, for low-risk development. And again, what that is one end of the continuum for how the risk-reward of the incentive-based system operates. Ultimately, what we have to have for there to be creativity is there has to be enough reward to motivate people to participate. That doesn't mean that everybody has to get the reward or that the rewards have to be exactly proportional to what people do. But what it is that motivates some segment of the population has to be incented financially. I don't think we see in areas where there is, in fact, no copyright or extremely high infringement, so the equivalent of no copyright, nearly the same level of open source type development, whether it's open source software, community theater, music. Without the incentives at the high end, there's much less activity at the communal level as well. So I think they go together rather than are in conflict.
It's an interesting topic, and as you might expect, I don't entirely agree, and so I'll push back a little bit in the interest of having that discussion, which I guess is to perhaps draw an analogy and get your reaction to it, which is Chris Sprigman at UVA has written, along with Cal Rustiella, UCLA, has written an interesting article focusing on the fashion industry. And which I'm sure you're familiar with. And the basic gist of it is that we find in the fashion industry a lack of enforcement of copyright, even where there could be that enforcement, and yet the industry has thrived. And we see, and I take your point about community theater as being an older example, clearly at a more entrenched example of what you're describing. But I guess, does the nature of technology change the analysis? The fashion industry would suggest that there are certain industries that can thrive in the absence of having that strong enforcement. And so it stands as kind of an interesting counterbalance to the question. But the larger issue, I think, and the one I want to push back on, is whether the nature of technology, and that is the idea that there is a wide sharing of information that exists, and that that sharing of information through technology, through all of the cliches that we know about the internet, means that there are different ways of production or new ways of production, and perhaps different motivators, meaning that the utilitarian theory itself may require some tweaking.
Let me start back a ways. My earliest experience in intellectual property was through the clothing industry, having been part of a family business that was in that field. And I remember very vividly, and perhaps is one of the things that drew me to the field that I'm in, having designed what I thought were some fairly innovative products, only to see them on the shelves of the store that they had been pitched to 2 months later, having been manufactured overseas and purchased by a company other than ours. Most manufacturing for those products is no longer done in the United States because it is a commodity business at the lower end rather than in business with any exclusivity or intellectual property. What we've replaced that with in the fashion industry is, of course, trademark. And so the designer label, the designer name has created the exclusivity and the separation from company to company. It's impossible to say whether we would have a better fashion industry or more innovation in clothing if we had a different kind of regime. And my wife, I think, would suggest that I'm something of a troglodyte to say all little black dresses look the same.
Right.
But personally, I don't see a lot of innovation. I don't see a lot of creativity. Clothing is clearly objectively necessary. It's highly relevant. The fashion name, the brand, is highly subjectively relevant. So we're not going to get rid of the consumption, but I don't see a terribly healthy industry in terms of how the industry operates based on the regime that exists today. So I'm not clearly there is going to be the purchase and sale of clothes, and food, similarly, doesn't really need either copyrights or patents or trademarks for the commodities to be purchased and sold. But I'm not sure that the size of the market dictates the health or growth or development of the market.
And that's a fair point. And do you think that the technology plays a role in rethinking or at least reconsidering the utilitarian theory as we've known it up to now?
I think it does. And my political bias is I'm not in favor of adding copyright or sui generis protection, unique protection for the fashion industry, because I don't think, given the state of the industry today, the requests that industry leaders are asking for are going to necessarily improve the state of the art for the consumers or be economically efficient. So having said that, I do have some sympathy for the designers today who are complaining that, unlike years past, when a high-end outfit was knocked off, there was a six-month to year lag time as the articles were seen in the stores, copied illicitly, however that was done, in the fashion stores, brought back to the manufacturers, and then reintroduced to the market a cycle or a season later. Today, the new innovation is literally hitting the shelves within days of the exclusive items hitting the shelves because they can be digitally reproduced. The designs can be kind of scanned from photographs of the designer show, and the knockoff manufacturers can get to market as fast or faster than the designers do. So there's clearly a transition going on in fashion because technology has undermined the life cycle of how products are distributed. And at some point, it could lead to significant economic upheaval in the fashion industry. I think the same thing is true of product cycles across the board. And you know, ultimately, to the extent that intellectual property is an economic engine for economic health, I think the real question is not is there product and trade, but are we getting the right kind of economic health? And, of course, that goes to not intellectual property itself, but the quality of jobs, the environmental issues, And it can be suggested, I think, as many people have pointed out, that as we push commodity prices lower and lower, what we do is actually create bad conditions, bad working conditions, bad environmental conditions. And at some point, economic cheapness is not economic efficiency. We have to be careful of that.
Yeah, and that's perhaps a topic for another discussion, but that issue comes up, as you know, in some of the work that Eric von Hippel and others have done. And that's a fascinating issue in and of itself. We will, however, take a very short break here, where I am now going to stop the conversation for a moment and just do what I do on every show, which is to mention that KZSU is a non-commercial and non-profit radio station at Stanford University that relies on the donations of listeners like you to continue its programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. Speaking of different ways that businesses can operate, one way is through donations, which I'm not sure is really a viable theory for the average business, but indeed in the nonprofit sector it works quite well. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do ask you to continue listening to KZSU and its varied programming, and if you consider making a donation, that would be wonderful. So let's come back to the conversation with Dean John Garron of Hamline University School of Law, author of the book Own It, The Law and Business Guide to Launching a New Business Through Innovation, Exclusivity, and Relevance. And let's pick another non-controversial topic, and I'm using that facetiously, but the issue of fair use. And fair use gets a ton of press, and indeed, I think, if there's ever an example of, I think, the public generally misunderstanding a concept in intellectual property law, it would be fair use, because I'm sure you have the same experience, which is pretty much if anyone takes something without permission, they just say, well, it's fair use. And I've had that discussion endlessly, saying, well, let's wait a minute. There are certain fair uses, and there are certain uses that aren't fair. But what's your opinion, John, in terms of where fair use is today? Where do you think the balance is?
Well, I think fair use is one of the most hotly debated, as you said, misunderstood concepts, both in the public and to a certain extent in the academic community, because we focus on its margins and not on its core. The original intent of fair use, comment, criticism, education, I think is actually very healthy today. The problem is that there's a second layer that surrounds fair use. Copyright historically had been highly normative, and so many activities were not fair use necessarily, but neither were they worthy of action. And so there was this second layer of potentially infringing activity that was treated as no harm, no foul. As the digital world has grown, we seem to be faced with this dichotomy that either everything is going to be pirated or everything is going to be owned. And we need to return to a regime that allows fair use or some other kind of normative value to create that space to allow for the leakage between enforcement and the law.
Do you think, just to gauge your opinion, that the balance as it currently exists is way off the mark, or do you think that, I mean, in other words, do you think that fair use has gone too far in the direction of allowing for non-permissive uses through its rubric, or do you think that perhaps that it needs to be rethought entirely?
One of the problems with understanding the answer to that question is I don't think fair use is actually monolithic. The fair use litigation cases that are litigated actually have very different outcomes if you break them down by type of use or by sector. And when you bundle them together under legal constructs, the area becomes incoherent, quite frankly. But if you look, for example, at literary criticism, we have seen that the courts, by and large, have expanded the notion of fair use and allow a generally robust exploitation of an author's work by third parties looking for comment or criticism. There are some notable exceptions to that. part of Sony when that case was first decided, assumptions that librarying could never be fair use, where time shifting was the only acceptable fair use, and at the same time, the court taking note that at $20 to $25 per videotape, people would generally never have much of this in their home. And you compare that to where we are today with a real move to accept the notion that home personal backup copies are a fair use, and that the industries, whether it be the music industry or software industry, have by and large conceded the point, without ever there being significant litigation, that a personal backup copy is just within the social acceptable fair use, is a significant growth in where fair use is. In other areas, however, we see that fair use is much harder to understand, that the owners of copyright have become far more demanding. And so in the areas, probably the area that bothers me the most is in documentary filmmaking, mm-hmm. where the costs associated with small music clips have really undermined the ability of particularly nonfiction storytellers, news-type producers to be able to tell actual stories, because these relatively trivial amounts of content are being defended voraciously. So you have a real mix going on, and I think that's what leads to confusion.
The in discussing the issue of fair use, but also the issue of copyright duration with lawyers in the entertainment industry, and I, in fact, in a previous life as a litigator, you know, did represent portions of the entertainment industry as an associate in a law firm. One of the arguments that comes up from the standpoint of why copyright protection is necessary across the board and why perhaps fair use has gone too far is the argument that in order to finance the creation of works today, those royalties need to be collected on previous works, and that therefore the need to have a long duration of copyright, and you know, at this point the duration being exceptionally long in my view, and in fact too long, is that you need this current source of revenue to create now. What do you make of that idea, and does it fit in, or does it connect with the idea of exclusivity that you discuss in the book?
I think the economic model makes complete sense. Whether the most recent, the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, and the additional 20 years that Congress enacted a few years ago was economically rational can be highly debated. I was one of the many, many faculty who participated in Larry Lessig's attempt to repeal that act, although my book is a different legal concept, I just felt it was economically irrational, particularly for works that had already been under contract, because it added so little value in terms of the present value for most of the works. The other issue that I think ties into that is something that was an unintended consequence of the 76 Copyright Act, the modern copyright law, which is the presumption that everything is protected by copyright. And we're missing the ability for things that nobody wants to enforce to passively fall out of copyright protection. That, much more than the term of copyright, I think is the biggest structural change to copyright that led to this notion of too much copyright ownership. There is too much copyright ownership, and that's because the assumption is, in the absence of any activity by anyone, ownership is presumed. Under the law up until 1978, as you know, without some affirmative step, the presumption was that the copyright fell into the public domain after a much shorter period of time, and as a result, only those small percentage of products that actually had ongoing economic value continued to be protected by copyright.
The nature of this, and before we move on, I think I want to ask you is, given the theory that you express in Own It, how would fair use or the possibility of fair use aid, implement, or undermine the kind of model that that you would expect to exist for those reading the book, and how should they take into account the possibility of fair use?
One must remember that, particularly for copyright, everyone is both a producer and a consumer. So the whatever the company's business is, it is both creating content about its products and services, creating websites, publishing material, and also consuming the writings of the companies that have gone before, of the editorials that are written about the product. And so a fairly generous fair use allows companies, particularly startup companies that don't have a lot of resources, to license all of the source material that they need to be more successful. So the business model of the modern industry really assumes that there is access to content, that everything doesn't have a dollar attached to it. We need a fairly robust fair use industry or aspect of the industry to allow startups to exist. You know, for example, if in promoting my book, which obviously I want to do, I wasn't able to take excerpts out of this interview and post them on my own website because there was no fair use for copying those short clips, I would be at a disadvantage. Having a fair use ability to say, you know, you made some kind comments about the book at the top of the hour, and so I'm going to point to those when I link to the Hearsay Culture site, that promotes my book, even though clearly as a book author, I want copyright enforcement for the book as a whole. I also want to encourage reviewers and critics to look at the book critically, and that means I have to accept that they're going to publish excerpts from the book in order to do that. It's part of the quid pro quo.
And indeed, I can even help you a step further there, because I step out of the traditional copyright regime entirely with this show and distribute it under a Creative Commons license. That basically allows just for what you describe through attribution. But indeed, even the fair use aspect of it would say, you know what, my Creative Commons license aside, you can do what you want. So it's an interesting dichotomy where even the Creative Commons license may not necessarily allow for any change in the fair use construct. And so it leads me to kind of another area that you discuss, and one that got a little bit of press not too long ago, which is, you mentioned the bottled water industry on page 57 of your book, and it's one that has been debunked at some level based upon the representations about the source of the water. You note that they've survived despite a lack of what you call value, and I think that that's a fair point. How do you account for the success of an industry like that?
Well, and I try to use the bottled water industry as the best example of social relevance, because at least in the United States, we don't have bottled water as a necessity for lack of a clean water system. Right? Having traveled to Indian countries where bottled water has a very different role, it's important to make that distinction. Here, it really comes down to a matter of convenience and socialization, with socialization being really the key. The other piece of it, of course, is that there is a implicit relationship between the water bottling companies and the retailers. So if you walk into the modern movie theater, your choice is bottled water. Maybe they'll give you an extremely flimsy and extremely small cup to give you tap water extremely grudgingly. Right? 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there would have been water fountains in that motion picture lobby. And so we see that it is in the entire stream of commerce, all of the participants' interest, that we move to this valueless resource, this expensive resource that creates landfill and other problems, simply because at every step in the process, the fact that it's now a sole product creates a revenue for every participant.
We don't have a lot of time left, and there are a number of topics that we could discuss. I do want to ask you, before we kind of close a bit, which is the issue of software patents, another extremely hot area in intellectual property. And you mentioned the example of VisiCalc, and perhaps you could explain it quickly, but I was wondering whether in reading the story, with the debate that comes up with software patents is, of course, whether they're needed in the first place, and whether the patent monopoly reward is really necessary there. How does the VisiCalc example make the point, or does it make the point, that software patents are necessary? And do you think, in fact, we need software patents?
Well, certainly the VisiCalc example does not stand for the proposition that software patents are necessary. The point behind the VisiCalc story is, of course, that the right people were not rewarded because there was no intellectual property protection that was sought by the creators of that product. And so other companies, particularly Microsoft, moved into the market. And it's a great example of why you need some exclusivity, because in the absence of any exclusivity, it is those companies who have the strongest marketing powers that will be rewarded for innovation rather than the innovators. Having said that, my instinct is that software patents, generally speaking, do not provide much social utility, primarily because the turnaround time of the industry is so short that the real benefits to the exclusivity through patent processing is simply irrelevant to the actual market on the ground. And there would be just as much or more innovation without the confounds created by the risk of patents springing up to interfere with companies. Given all of the dynamics of the software industry today, it's creating more economic cost and confusion than incenting the right innovation, and so we would probably be better served without it.
And I think, I mean, I think there I agree with you. And in fact, you know, as we look increasingly at the nature of software patents and generally, you know, overlaying all of that is the many and myriad flaws in the patent system, which we've discussed on this show with Mark Lemley and David Olson and others. I think if there's an industry where it needs to be rethought quickly, it is software patents, because ultimately the locking up of that information can go very much against some of the core ideas that you suggested and own it in terms of being able to get access to knowledge in the first place.
And again, if you look at the core principles of own it or the example of MIT, software patents attach well before there's any notion of what the economic value of the product or of the company really is going to be. And so oftentimes we're protecting the wrong things for the wrong reason, and it's expensive to buy protection. So the result of the software patents is actually to dilute or distract companies rather than to promote their success. And that's one of the reasons that even with the availability of software patents, you see so many companies choosing not to pursue them.
It leads me really to the last question before we sum up, which is, and I think I have an idea of it here, but I'd be curious to get your description. What would be an emblem of success for a reader for your book? What would you hope to accomplish at the end of the day were you to speak to someone that read your book now and then you chatted with them 2 years from now?
Well, the most important thing that the book helps a business entrepreneur do is understand their own business. It helps them make choices about how their business is going to be relevant in the market, what they want to be exclusive. And then another chapter that we haven't talked about at all is what is their particular role in the company, because, and I'm sure you've seen this in practice as well, entrepreneurs have a very different view of their role depending on the nature of whether they are inventors, whether they are going to be actively participating in the company, whether they are, you know, envisioning the dot-com opportunities. And so the book really helps to walk that process for the entrepreneur and clarify what they want out of the business. With that done and the tools of the intellectual property regime available, my hope is to see many more startups succeed on a percentage basis than ever before. And, you know, my strongest wish is to hear from the purchasers of Own It, the kind of stories I hear from my filmmaking book. I read your book. It got me back on the right path. This is what I'm doing today. I was successful. Thank you very much. That's really the kind of success that I hope the book brings to people, and that's clearly what I'm looking for with each of the books, that's what it allows people to accomplish.
for those that want to learn more about your book and about your ideas, where can they go?
Well, the book is available on Amazon.com, and that's probably the easiest place to purchase the book. There's also a website, lawbizbooks.com, B-I-Z, lawbizbooks.com, that has information on all of my books, as well as an own-it blog that allows people to ask questions and see kind of the evolution of the issues that are going on as the book is out in the marketplace.
Dean John Garin, author of the book Own It, The Law and Business Guide to Launching a New Business Through Innovation, Exclusivity, and Relevance. Thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
So I want to thank again the Dean for being on the show. And like I said, we've focused on Hearsay Culture on a lot of these issues. And we haven't spent as much time really on the practical side of it. And again, I think this book does an excellent job not only of really bringing the potential entrepreneur through that step-by-step analysis, but as we flesh out some of these ideas in discussion today, I think we can also see that this is a nuanced discussion, and so Dean Garin brings in that perspective of where the law should be a bit in the book, which I think distinguishes it from a lot of the other how-to type books. And I would add again, while it's not a real topic of discussion for the radio show, but the second part of the book, the Intellectual Property Law Guide, I think is a very nice overview of the law there as well, and makes it accessible to the non-lawyer and to the potential entrepreneur. So I want to thank Dean Garin for being on the show today. We're going to continue Hearsay Culture schedule through November and into December with a number of authors, including Alex Wright, the author of Glut, and John Walensky at Stanford, author of The Access Principle, as well as Kristen Lord at George Washington University, who's written a fascinating book on public transparency and where it leads, called The Perils and Promise of Transparency, as well as other authors like Eric Davis, who was on the show previously discussing his book Technosis, and who's written a fascinating book on California mysticism, which certainly brings us into the technology realm directly, but also into this alter world of why it is that California, from a cultural perspective, has been a progenitor of technology. We're also going to have on later in the year Professor Rebecca Tushnet from Georgetown, who will be discussing trademark law and other focuses of her work, but particularly trademark law and issues of publicity. And I've also recently been able to announce that David Weinberger, author of the book Everything is Miscellaneous, will also be on the show later on in the year. And I'm in the process of working on other guests, which leads me to my closing point, which is if you have any suggestions for guests for the show, I do welcome them and your suggestions by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you can access the show not only on KZSU Live, but also through the podcast page on iTunes for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford by typing Center for Internet and Society into the podcast search engine. You can also find the show at hearsayculture.com, where you can not only find the show, but also find the schedule and my blog. And you can also get the podcast through the Center for Internet Society's own webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So thank you again for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more programming, and we will talk next week.